We're going to take our Bibles. Let's go to Genesis chapter 38. And as we go there, we're going to have all the young people, if you're up through the sixth grade, this morning, we're going to let you go down to junior church. You don't normally go, don't get used to it. I know you'd rather have Mrs. Bosico than me. We're in Genesis chapter 38 this morning. We're going to read through this text. I think it becomes pretty obvious why junior church is appropriate this morning as we read through the story of Judah and Tamar. We'll read through the story, then we'll pray and ask God to meet with us as we look at this text. Genesis 38, verse 1, the Bible says, "It happened at that time that Judah went down from his brothers and turned aside to a certain Adullamite, whose name was Hira. There Judah saw the daughter of a certain Canaanite, whose name was Shua. He took her and went into her, and she conceived and bore a son, and he called his name Ur. She conceived again and bore a son, and she called his name Onan. Yet again she bore a son, and she called his name Shelah. Judah was in Kezib when she bore him. And Judah took a wife for Ur, his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. But Ur, Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Lord. The Lord put him to death. Then Judah said to Onan, 'Go into your brother's wife and perform the duty of a brother-in-law to her and raise up offspring for your brother.' But Onan knew that the offspring would not be his. So whenever he went into his brother's wife, he would waste the semen on the ground so as not to give offspring to his brother. What he did was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and he put him to death also. Then Judah said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, 'Remain a widow in your father's house till Shelah, my son, grows up.' For he feared that he would die like his brothers. So Tamar went and remained in her father's house. In the course of time, the wife of Judah, Shua's daughter, died. When Judah was comforted, he went up to Timnah, to his sheep shearers, he and his friend Hira, the Adullamite. When Tamar was told, 'Your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep,' she took off her widow's garments and covered herself with a veil, wrapping herself up, and sat at the entrance of Enaim, which is on the road to Timnah. For she saw that Shelah was grown up, and she had not been given to him in marriage. When Judah saw her, he thought that she was a prostitute, for she had covered her face. He turned to her at the roadside and said, 'Come, let me come in to you,' for he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. She said, 'What will you give me, that you may come in to me?' He answered, 'I will send you a young goat from the flock.' She said, 'If you give me a pledge until you send it,' he said, 'What pledge shall I give you?' She replied, 'Your signet and your cord, and your staff that is in your hand.' So he gave them to her, and went into her, and she conceived by him. Then she arose and went away, and taking off her veil, she put on the garments of her widowhood. When Judah sent the young goat by his friend, the Adullamite, to take back the pledge from the one's hand, he did not find her. And he asked the men of the place, 'Where is the cult prostitute who is at Enaim at the roadside?' And they said, 'No cult prostitute has been here.' So he returned to Judah and said, 'I've not found her. Also, the men of that place say that no cult prostitute has been there.' And Judah replied, 'Let her keep the things as her own, or we shall be laughed at. You see, I sent this young goat, and you did not find her.' About 3 months later, Judah was told, 'Tamar, your daughter-in-law, has been immoral. Moreover, she's pregnant by immorality.' And Judah said, 'Bring her out and let her be burned.' She was being brought out. She sent word to her father-in-law, 'By the man to whom these belong, I am pregnant.' And she said, 'Please identify whose these are, the signet and the cord and the staff.' Then Judah identified them and said, 'She is more righteous than I, since I did not give her to my son Shelah.' And he did not know her again. When the time of her labor came, there were twins in her womb. And when she was in labor, one put out a hand, and the midwife took and tied a scarlet thread on his hand, saying, 'This one comes out first.' But as he drew back his hand, behold, his brother came out. And she said, 'What a breach you have made for yourself.' Therefore his name was called Perez, which means a breach. Afterward, his brother came out with the scarlet thread on his hand, and his name was called Zerah, or the Shining One." When we come to a text like this, we pray that my microphone's working. Sorry. Or maybe we don't. We'd rather just kind of skip over this kind of a text. In good company and in nice, polite company, we don't talk about these kinds of things, especially if we've grown up in a Christian home, if we are surrounded by Christian people, if we're not in and among those who live life in the raw, where this story obviously takes place. But this is life. This is real life story, and the Bible doesn't hide it from us. It doesn't apologize for it. It's not a very fun passage for us to look at. In fact, it's awkward. It's awkward to talk about. It's awkward to preach on. It's awkward even just to read. But the Bible doesn't shy away from it. And I'm thankful. Actually, as I was getting ready to work on this series, this was one of the passages that came to mind. And I kind of shuddered and said, oh, the rest of it's going to be fun, but that one's not going to be a fun one. But I think it's important for us to look at, because not only does the Bible tell the story here, but as we saw in the book of Matthew, the Bible references the story even in the line of Jesus. And it says that Perez is the son of Judah. And it says, by Tamar. And as you go through that lineage and the genealogy for Jesus, you see that not only Tamar is listed, but also Rahab, the harlot. And then you also see that Ruth, the Moabitess, is there. And then David had a son named Solomon by the wife of Uriah the Hittite. And the Bible doesn't gloss over these things. In fact, it seems to highlight the fact that despite the ugliness of sin, God wins. Despite the ugliness of our fallen condition, grace abounded where sin abounded. In fact, grace did much more abound. Aren't you thankful for that? Praise God, grace abounds. And so he connects this story in a unique way. And in setting the stage for the story of Christ, it's interesting which stories Matthew highlights, some of which we wouldn't necessarily be inclined to include, perhaps this one in particular. But as we see, God's not afraid to include these stories of human failure, particularly when they become the vehicles by which he displays his divine success. You come into a new year. You've got some resolutions. You look over the past year, you see where you've been successful. Praise God for his grace that's helped you succeed in the past year. You look to the future year, and you say, you know what? By God's grace, I'm going to succeed. And then there's that little haunting question in the back of your mind. But what if I don't? Who hasn't made a resolution and gotten 15 days, 15 weeks, 15 minutes into the new year, and you haven't failed, you haven't fallen on your face with the resolutions that you were so sure you were going to keep this year for sure? When you come to this story, as we enter a new year, I think the admonition is for us not to fear failure. Rather, when we fail, and we will, that we learn to fail well. It's always better not to fail, but you are going to fail. And when you fail, you must learn to fail well. This passage provides for us, I think, three lessons from a man who learned in his failure to fail well. In the first 11 verses of this chapter, the first lesson is explicated for us. And that is that failure never just happens. There's always a setting of the stage. Failure never just happens. Look at how the verse 1 starts. It just so happened at that time. It's kind of reminiscent of the book of Ruth later on. She happened to go out into a field, and it just happened to be the field of Boaz. What the Bible emphasizes when it uses this term that we tend to use so frequently, it just happened. What a coincidence. With God, there's no coincidence. Or as listening to The Hiding Place recently, as Corey would often be reminded by her sister Betsy, With God, there are no ifs. Okay? It just so happened. Well, no. It happened by choice. It just so happened that at that time, Judah made the choice to go down from his brothers and to turn aside to a certain Adullamite. You see, Judah's failure occurred in part because he left his brothers and he befriended the world. Chris was talking about this in Sunday school this morning. It's kind of the Psalm 1, verse 1 syndrome. Blessed is the man that walks not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor stands in the way of sinners, nor sits in the seat of the scornful. What Judah is doing at this point in the story is he's choosing up sides. He's choosing up loyalties. He's choosing up friends and companions with whom to do life. Now, he didn't leave a great lot behind. His brothers, which are all kind of a raw bunch who've sold off their brother and pocketed two pieces of silver each. This is the group that he left behind. Not a great group, but the group that's tied to the promises and the blessings of God. And as he leaves off this group, it says he went down. The language parallels Joseph's going down to Egypt in chapter 39, verse 1. The idea is moving away from the place of blessing. And that's exactly what's happening as Judah makes up his mind to turn away from, and that's the next phrase then. He turned away. And that's what the Bible uses when it talks about all we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned everyone to our own way. That's exactly what Judah's doing at this point. Leaving off his brothers, leaving off Jacob, to whom the promises have been given, and deciding not to side with the covenant community, but moving off into friendship with the world. We see that his failure in part occurred because he left his brothers and befriended the world, but it also happened in part because he allowed himself to become unequally yoked. Verse 2. There, with his worldly friend, Judah saw the daughter of a certain Canaanite, whose name was Shua. He took her, the idea is as a wife, went into her, she conceived and bore a son, and so on and so forth. In essence, what happens for Judah at this point is that he becomes a second Esau. We're familiar with the story of Esau, how that he's living in Canaan and he marries a couple of Canaanite wives. They please him, and so he grabs them, kind of like Samson later on in the story. He sees her, she's pretty, he wants her, he takes her. In fact, the language is reminiscent of what happens earlier in Genesis, in Genesis 3:6, where Eve saw the fruit. She saw that it was to be desired, and she took it. In Genesis chapter 6, where the sons of God see the daughters of man, and they see and they take for themselves. In Genesis chapter 12, where Pharaoh sees that Sarah's beautiful and takes her for himself. Abimelech in chapter 20. That's the idea of he sees, he wants, he takes for himself. He aligns himself with those then who are cursed. It emphasizes in verse 2 here, the daughter of a certain, what nationality was she? She's a what? She's a Canaanite. Canaan, the one who bears the curse, all the way back to Abraham. And that's been the driving force in this story. Abraham, the blessed. Canaan, the cursed. And I want to be a part of the blessing. I want to avoid the people of the curse. So when it's time for Abraham's son of promise to find a wife, he sends him all the way back to Padanaram so that he doesn't become one with the people of the curse. When Jacob finds it convenient to leave, Isaac says, you know what, I want you to go back to Padanaram so that you don't become united with the people of the curse. And now Judah throws all of that to the wayside and says, let me at it. I want what I want. I'm going to get it any way I can. Later we're going to see as he gives up some of the most costly things that he has, that he's going to sell his future for one little moment of pleasure. Just like Esau sold his birthright just for one bowl of soup. You remember the story? In essence, what we have here with Judah is a second telling of the story of Esau. That's because he allowed himself to become unequally yoked. His failure occurred in part because he neglected responsibilities at home. We find out that his wife conceives, bears a son. Judah calls him Ur. She conceives again, verse 4, bears another son, calls him Onan. Ur means the watcher. Onan means strength. Verse 5, she bore another son. She called his name Shelah. The word name Shelah means he that breaks. Ur is the only son that Judah names. He's involved in the process. He's interested in this child. He's interested, apparently, in the process of being a father. He's interested in the fact that this is his firstborn. This is going to be the one that he passes on his name to. He passes on the inheritance. He passes on his identity. He gives everything to this one. The second son born, the wife names him. The third one's born, the wife names that one. There's a little note at the end of verse 5. Judah was in Chazib when she bore him. What's he doing in Chazib? We don't know. It doesn't elaborate. What does the word Chazib mean? There's some different options for it, but the one that is most frequent is that it's the city of lies. And what happens in Chazib stays in Chazib. You understand why, don't you? It's the city of lies. It's a city where you get what you want, paying whatever price you want for it. And what happens in Chazib stays in Chazib. And as his wife is giving birth to this third son, Judah's not even involved in the process. The last son, Shelah, he that breaks. It's going to be interesting that it's with regard to this son, finally, that Judah will be broken. That his pride is going to be broken. He's going to be embarrassed, but he's going to be broken finally. His failure continues in verse 6. Judah took a wife for Ur, his firstborn. Her name was Tamar. But Ur, the watcher, Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord put him to death. Where do you think Ur learned what he learned growing up? We're not told what all this wickedness is compounded of, comprised of. In fact, when we have that word wicked, we have the idea of Genesis chapter 6, where all the world was wicked and called down the judgment of God in the flood, or the Tower of Babel, where the world was wicked and it called down the judgment of God. And that's exactly what happens for Ur. It's interesting that the text has him called the one who watches. Watches whom? Watches Dad. Watches the choices that Dad's making. Watches Mom. The one that Dad chose out of all the women on earth with whom to become one with. A daughter of the cursed ones. Oh, he's watching. He learned. He learned well. Judah failed at home. Judah's failure occurred in part because he passed on his own self-focused values. Go back up to chapter 37, verse 26. Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is it if we kill our brother and conceal our blood, his blood?" It's not that he's opposed necessarily even to killing Joseph. But he says, hey, if we're going to get rid of the guy, we might as well what? We might as well get something out of it other than a stained coat to give to Dad. What profit is there? What's in it for us? And so they sell him for a measly 20 shekels of silver. How many does he get out of it? Benjamin's not a part of the guys now. Joseph's gone, so there's only 10 left. 20 divided by 10 is... So you get 2 pieces of silver out of this. Great profit? No, but it's better than nothing. Judah is out for himself. He's out to make a buck. He's out to make a profit. As long as it benefits him, it's going to be okay. You come down to this story where we're at. There, verse 2. He sees what he wants and he takes it. It's going to be useful for me. I can make a profit. with this. When we come down to the Tamar, verse 6, the word Tamar, the name means palm tree. It has the idea of an image of beauty. Especially this time of year, think palm trees, you're thinking, ah, okay? It's exactly what he thought when he saw this beautiful young girl. He says, I'm going to get her for my son. He takes her, and as long as she's useful, he keeps her. But as soon as she becomes unprofitable, what's he do with her? Done with that one. Go back to your daddy. Don't want you anymore. So then we come to Onan, verse 8. And Judah gives him the instruction to go and raise up an heir to his brother. And we have the gross scene where he goes into his brother's wife, and in the midst of their intimacies, he takes for himself and he gives nothing. Gross immorality. And the Bible says it's wickedness and God destroys him for it. Well, why was Onan so concerned with himself? Where did he pick that up? Maybe. We had a pretty good teacher. Dad, all of his life, is teaching his son, son, don't make a bargain where you don't get the better end of the deal. Son, don't you make a bargain where you don't get the better end of the deal. Well, how do I do that, Dad? Watch me. I'll show you how to make a bargain where you get the better end of the deal. I felt bad when I was, I think it was sixth grade. My dad would always send fruit roll-ups in my lunch. Fruit roll-ups are really fun to eat, but they last about that long and they're gone, okay? There was another kid in my class who had this really cool pencil box. And it had a little slide on it, had pencil sharpener, and then it had a little slide on there where it had all the numbers, 1 through 9. And you just had to slide the thing over, and you didn't have to do the math. You could just see, oh, 9 times 8 is, 72. I loved it. Okay, it made life easier for me. So at lunchtime, this fellow says, hey, give me a bite of your fruit roll-up. I said, no way. But I'll tell you what I'll do. You can have all of my fruit roll-up if you give me your pencil box. Oh, yeah, no problem. What an idiot. I've got this pencil box for the rest of my life. I'm going to have gray hair, and I'm not going to have to do multiplication tables. I love it. Okay. We're pretty good at this, aren't we? Making deals so that we come out with the better end of the bargain. Onan, it says in verse 9, knew that his offspring wouldn't be his. That all of daddy's stuff wouldn't go to Onan, but would go to grandson, the son of Ur by rights. What's in it for me? Where did he learn how to do this? You know what? He learned to do it from dad. When you look at this life, is it any real surprise that we're going to come down and we're going to see Judah fails, and he fails in a big way? No, it's really not any surprise, because failure never just happens. It's always set, the stage is always set by previous choices that you make. That's what the principle is in Proverbs chapter 7, where you have the young man who's wandering off into the red light district of town all by himself at the wrong time of day. And it just so happens that the wrong woman catches him. Would it have happened if he hadn't been there by himself at the wrong time of day? In the wrong place at the wrong... Not at all. Failure never just happens. There's always the setting of the stage. But I think a second principle we need to see is comes in verse 12 through 23. Failure is utterly degrading, regardless of the reasons that accompany it. As the story plays out, the reasons that Judah has for doing what he does, on the surface, they're quite reasonable. We can understand why he does what he does. If we were to crawl into his psychology, crawl into his mind, you know what? I can see why he did that. For one thing, he grew up in a tough family. He's the son of which wife? Remember? What's Judah's mom's name? Leah. Leah's the favored wife or the not-so-favored wife? So she's not the favorite wife. So he goes to meet Uncle Esau, something about wants to kill dad last time he saw him. I forget how that goes. But so they're going to meet Uncle Esau. And here's the wives and the servants and their sons out in front. Here's Judah with the unfavorite wife. And he looks back and he says, "Hey, Mom, how come mean old Esau is up there and Joseph and Rachel are way back there? What's going on? How come we're kind of like bodyguards for them? What's going on?" He wasn't the favorite in this whole thing, and he knew it. Joseph gets this coat of many colors. Why? He's daddy's favorite. And he was pretty obvious about it. And you stop and think about it. Judah had a right, didn't he? To have some pleasure in life. I mean, he always got the short end of the stick. Sometimes somebody has to look out for number one, and he's finally going to do that at this point. You stop and think about it, you know what? It makes sense. He's lost two sons up to this point. In fact, it tells us that the time that this happened, verse 12, in the course of time, his wife dies. So he's just lost his wife. He's been grieving his wife. And now he only has one son left, and the only prospect of having any grandkids is by Tamar, who's 0 for 2. In fact, she's probably the reason that both my boys are dead. She's a jinx. You stop and think about it. Yeah. Life owes me something at this point. It occurs at a difficult moment in his life. It occurs at an unguarded moment in his life. Friend comes up to him and says, "Hey, sheep shearing time." And we're all like, "Boy, that sounds like a lot of work. That doesn't sound very fun." Hey, I listen to Steve tell the stories and I say, "Man, I'm glad you're a farmer and not me." Wrestling these sheep. Sheep shearing is like harvest time. You shear the sheep, then you get paid. That's the idea, okay? As long as you can do it in the right way. So this is a time of joy. It's a time of celebration. It's a time when you kind of let your hair down. And that's what they're planning to do. He goes with his friend. He goes to this pagan village. And the idea is Tamar comes to the village. She sets herself up there on the side of the road. It would not be out of place during sheep shearing season, at least in this culture, to see temple prostitutes there on the side of the road. What happened is, as you come to the end of a season where things have gone well, you look forward to the next season and you want it to go well again. In order for things to go well, you need to invoke the favor of the gods, okay, by their thinking. In order to do that, you play out the saga of the gods. And part of that was sexual intercourse with a prostitute, hoping to encourage the fertility gods to be favorable to you. So what's happening in this city, he knows what's going to happen. In fact, he's looking forward to what's going to happen in this pagan city. When it happens, a woman is there, she's available on the side of the road, and he doesn't have a clue, it says. Why? She's put off her widow garments, and she's covered herself with a veil. There were two different levels of immorality in that culture. The one didn't cover themselves with a veil, they just made themselves available. They were kind of the hardcore, bottom rung, what we would think of as a slut. Okay. The other was the temple prostitute who would cover herself, and actually the word that's going to be used in just a little bit is holy woman. She was married generally, and she served in the temple, and she had a higher station in life. And that's how Tamar presents herself. So as you look at how this comes into play, you know, it kind of makes sense, at least from Judah's perspective. Life's been hard, and it's been really hard recently. We're just going to have a little bit of fun. But in the end, the folly of Judah appears quite irrational. It makes no sense. And honestly, you and I know this. Sometimes we know it from experience. But sin never makes sense. It just doesn't. It looks like it's going to on the front end, but on the backside, sin never makes sense. And this story presents it in that way, and it does a good job of doing so. This temptation toys with the values at which Judah is adept. Judah, how about some immediate pleasure? You don't have to pay till later. Well, who doesn't like that? Give me another credit card. Get me the fun up front. I don't have to pay for it till later. In fact, sign me up for the 0% financing. Okay? What a bargain. Immediate pleasure. There's going to be a future price, and we find out what that future price is. It's a significant pleasure for what seems to be an insignificant price. It's sheep shearing time. What's the price of this prostitute? A little lamb. A young one. How many does he got? I don't know. We're not told. But probably several. This is just one, and it's a little one. Not a big deal. I can have everything for hardly anything. This is what he was building his life on, wasn't it? But it's going to make him look absolutely like an idiot. It's all said and done. It strikes at the heart of who he is. She says, what will you give me? Verse 16, so you can come into me. He says, I'll send you a young goat from the flock. She says, if you give me a pledge till you send it. So what shall I give you as a pledge? He replies, I want your signet, your cord, and the staff that's in your hand. The signet and the staff in particular, the signet was held by the cord. That's why she mentions that. The signet is probably a cylinder that they would use. It was carved, and it would have some symbol that represented Judah in particular. Nobody else had the same signet that he did. It wasn't a ring per se. It was a cylinder that they would roll on the wax, and it would say bought by Judah or property of Judah. And it meant it belonged to him. It was his signature. The staff was the idea of, it was probably an ornate staff. The staff was also one of those things that symbolized their station in society. It was absolutely unique. Nobody would have the same one, and there was usually something they were rather proud of. Both the signet and the staff would be highly personalized. Ian DeGede says that they were the ancient equivalent of Judah's wallet, complete with driver's license and credit cards. I can have everything for nothing. Oh, just a little sheep. What do you want in the meantime? Your wallet, your driver's license, your credit cards. Okay, yeah, I'll get them all back. Gives them all to her. She required these accessories of Judah's life, if you will, because she knew Judah at this point by more than just his accessories. She knew what kind of a guy he was. She knew that he was kind of like Laban, that you never get the better end of the deal when it comes to Judah. And so here, Judah, here's what I want. I want a promise that you're going to come through on this deal, even though she doesn't plan on ever receiving or giving them back. It reveals the vanity of trying to justify ourselves. And in the end, Judah tries to get back his signet and his staff. He tries to give the payment, the small little payment that he promised. He tries to come through on the deal. They just can't find this woman anywhere. And finally, he tells his friend, listen, stop looking. Stop asking. Don't say anything more. Why? People are going to start laughing at us. This is embarrassing. I lost everything for what? And it's gone. And he says, well, at least you, my friend, know that I have integrity. Yeah, some integrity. Trying to justify. Don't we all do that, though? When it's all said and done, we've compromised. We've failed. And then we try to justify ourselves. Well, at least here's why I did it. And in the end, all that we offer sounds absolutely stupid. Because it is. And it is for Judah as well. It's ominous that the town in which this takes place, up there in verse 14, she sat at the entrance to Enaim. This ominously alludes to the name, to what's happening. The name Enaim means either twin wells, and it either speaks of the fact that he's operating at two levels, with a prostitute who's his daughter-in-law, or it speaks of the fact that two sons will be born of this union. Another way to translate it is the entrance to Enaim means the opening of the eyes, and several favor this translation as what happens here behind the veil is ultimately going to open the eyes of Judah so that he sees, you know what? She's more righteous than me. I've been playing a game for too long. Two lessons we learn in this so far is that failure never just happens. You always set the stage for your own failure. And failure is utterly degrading regardless of what reasons we can provide for it. But I think the third lesson is most important as we wrap up this morning. Verses 24 through 30. Failure is never the end of the story, no matter how low one goes. 2015, a year of hope, a year of promise, a year of excitement, anticipation, a year when you find out that you're capable of incredible ugliness. You've never spoken those words before, and all of a sudden they've come out of your mouth and you can never take them back. You've never ventured a look in that direction before, and now you have, and oh, you wish you hadn't. You've compromised in some way. That person you wanted to witness to ends up dying. And you can never speak the name of Christ to them again. Here's the good news of the gospel, folks. It's why Jesus came. When you fail, and you will, it's never the end of the story, regardless of how low you find yourself. So, after stooping to immorality, as if that's not enough, Judah compounds his sin with hypocrisy. Verse 24, about 3 months later, Judah's told Tamar, your daughter-in-law, has been prostituting, is the word. Moreover, she's pregnant by prostituting. Judah said, bring her out and let's ask her about this. Let's find out about this. What's he say? Get rid of her. Burn her. He's probably thinking at this point, finally, now Sheila won't have to die by the jinx. Okay? I can just conveniently get rid of her and move on with my life. Now we can cover up that ugly chapter in my history. At least something's going right for me, finally. Just 3 months before, he had been prostituting, and now he hypocritically condemns his daughter-in-law for her prostituting. Ironically, the term that's used as they're looking for this girl is that cult prostitute. Perhaps that word isn't used very much in the Old Testament, in the Hebrew, because it has the word kadosh in it. And most of the time, the word kadosh is used in the Old Testament. It has the idea of holiness unto the true God. It's righteousness, it's separateness, it's set apart unto the true God. When it was used in regard to the other gods, the untrue gods, it's not really holiness as in righteousness, it's holiness as in set apart for what all those gods represent, set apart for debauchery, set apart for indulgence. So the Bible doesn't use this very often, but it wouldn't be improper to translate this word a holy woman. Where's the holy woman? Where's the one who's set apart? And as this story plays out, we'll see that Tamar is pardoned as holy, or at least more righteous than Judah. Before we start to throw stones at Tamar for what she did, In her culture, there were laws that said specifically, if the first husband doesn't give you a son, a child, and the brother doesn't give you a child, then you marry the father. That was written into their pagan code. Okay. All of this precedes what we're given in the law of Moses. So before we go backwards and start throwing stones at Tamar and saying, how could she do this? She's operating with a whole different set of worldview than what we have on this side of the cross. And as she's brought before Judah, the irony of the story is that this woman who posed as a holy woman really is shown to be more righteous than the one who's promised the blessing. In her pardon, she becomes one of the heroes of Israel. I want you to go forward to Ruth, the book of Ruth, chapter 4. Keep your fingers back here, but Ruth chapter 4. You'd think with a story like this, everybody would say the name of Tamar and then they'd spit. Tamar, yeah. That's not it at all. Tamar becomes one of the heroines of the faith in the Old Testament. We come up to verse 11 in chapter 4. And all the people who were at the gate and the elders said, we are witnesses, Boaz, that you've taken Ruth. May the Lord make this woman who's coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel. May you act worthily, honorably in Ephratah, and be renowned in Bethlehem. And may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah, because of the offspring that the Lord gives you by this young woman. May you be blessed and renowned and famous, even like Tamar. Wow. That's kind of backwards from the way I would have put the story. And in her pardon, we read it already in the book of Matthew, she becomes immortalized as one of the forerunners of the promised Messiah. I'm going to read a short section here by Walter Brueggemann. I need you to catch this, okay? This narrative contains a radical critique of morality for those who will pursue it. The text makes a judgment about relative guilt. Tamar's committed the kind of sin that good people prefer to condemn. She engages in deception and illicit sex and brings damages to a good family. For a moment, until he's made aware of his own involvement, Judah reacts on the basis of this easy morality. But in that context, a new insight about righteousness comes out of the mouth of Judah. He draws an unexpected conclusion. In the midst of this sordid story of sexuality, there's a new understanding of what righteousness is. The story may give us pause about the usual bourgeois dimensions of sin. What's taken more seriously is not a violation of sexual morality, but the damage to the community, which includes a poor, diminished widow. Remember when Jesus is on earth, who does he spend his time with? Tax collectors and sinners, which includes harlots, right? What are you doing spending your time with harlots? Well, you know what? Somebody who finds themselves in that kind of condition doesn't have to wonder whether or not they're a sinner. It's those of us who are so cleaned up, who tend to think of ourselves as maybe a little better than the next guy, because we would never do, and we can fill in the blank. And in this context, we see that Judah, all scrubbed and clean, collared and tie around his neck, taking his place in society, says, you know what? This one's been more right than me, because with all that I had, I didn't even take care of looking out for her. I was still looking out for myself. That's the ugliness of sin. Oh, sometimes we don't see it until we fall in a big way. But here's the thing, folks. When we fall and we fall big, we think we're done. But sometimes God can't move us to that next step until we see ourselves the way God sees us. And what happens in this passage? Exactly that. Judah, for the first time in his life, finally sees himself as only focused on himself. And for the first time in his life, he begins to be concerned about somebody else. What an amazing thing. After condemning others with hypocrisy, Judah now turns from his own sin in humility. Judah's hard heart needed to be broken, and it finally was. The punctuation, the punchline in this story, comes in verse 25. As she's being brought out, she sends word to her father-in-law, "By the man to whom these belong, I'm pregnant." Please identify this signet, cord, and staff. Please identify these. These words had to haunt Judah because just before, one chapter before in this story, we're not told how many months. This is probably right before they go down to Egypt, some 22 years later after Joseph sold into slavery. But when Judah covers up his sin with regard to Joseph, remember the message he sends back to Dad? "Dad, here's a coat. Would you please identify this?" The exact same phrase is used as Tamar is being brought to the stake. She says, "Judah, would you please identify these?" How that had to smite him, and how it did smite him. God's work of conviction struck deeply. And for those of us who've ever experienced conviction, we know it hurts. It's not fun, but it's precious. Because what conviction does for us is it doesn't allow us to stay the same as we are. And sometimes the only way we can face that is through failure. So Judah's confession goes beyond the embarrassment of being caught. "Oh, yeah, that was me." He says, "You know what? She's right. I'm wrong. In fact, she's better than I am. Whoever conceals his transgression will not prosper. But he who confesses and forsakes them will find what? Mercy." You know what? "I'm not as big as I thought I was." Well, now you finally know what everybody else knew but you. Okay. And now God can pour his mercy into your life. When Judah confesses this, he says, "It's me." The text says, and he never knew her again. He didn't take advantage of her from that point on. You know, Judah's a born leader. When it comes to Joseph, let's not kill him. Let's sell him. Let's make a profit on this. Okay. Judah's going to be brought back into a position of leadership later on. His dad's going to say, "You know what, boys? I just can't do it. I can't send Benjamin." Judah now is used to taking responsibility, used to taking blame for things. He says, "Dad, I know what you're saying. My brother Reuben says you can kill his kids, but they're your grandkids. Why would you want to kill his kids? That's stupid. Dad, let me be security for Benjamin. If we go down, if we lose him, I'll be the blame. I'll bear that. Okay, that's mine. I promise, Dad, I'll bring him back." And he finally is the one who leads Dad and the brothers in what's going to break through into their salvation. As we come to the end of this story, we have the twins born. And the one puts out his hand, they tie a ribbon around it, pulls his hand back in, and the other one breaks through. The younger one who comes out first. And again, the idea is, Judah, you wanted to get rid of the youngest son so you could put yourself forward. It doesn't work that way with God. God chooses whom he chooses to do what he wants to. But you know what, Judah? As Joseph's going to bear the blessing, the firstborn, in fact, Ephraim, his youngest, is going to bear that blessing. There's one blessing I'm not going to give to Joseph. I'm saving that, Judah, for you. And that is, Judah, as one who not only sins, but humbles yourself in repentance, and then offers yourself in sacrificial obedience, I want you to be the forebearer of my son, Jesus Christ, the Messiah.
What a story. A beautiful story? Absolutely. An ugly story? Yes. This is a story that we're not comfortable with. But this is a story that your coworker is living with today. This is a story that one of your nephews or nieces is dealing with. Perhaps sexual abuse. All the sordidness and ugliness of this. As we come to this new year, it's better that we don't fail. Especially big. And you don't have to. Okay, but when you fail, you don't need to be paralyzed by your failure. Rather, when you fail, learn to fail well. In fact, you can learn to fail forward, because that's how God always chooses to use failures in the lives of those who belong to Him. Let's pray.